And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And the opinions that you hear on this show are those of me and my guest and not those of the University of California Regents. Today my guest is Vicky Bouger, a literary agent based in New York City. Vicky Bouger started her agency in 1988 after 10 years at Oxford University Press. She represents both fiction and nonfiction. The books she represents have appeared in the New York Times Notable Books of the Year, Los Angeles Times Best Fiction of the Year, Washington Post Book World Rave Reviews of the Year, and have been nominated for the LA Times Book Award as well as the National Book Critics Circle Award. Three of her mystery writers have won the Edgar Award. Vicky has served as president of the AAR, which is the Association of Authors Representatives, the only organization of literary and dramatic agents in the United States. And she's a member of the Authors Guild, PEN, Women's Media Group, and Mystery Writers of America. For 2 years, she taught a course, The Role of the Literary Agent, at the NYU School of Continuing Education. Hi, Vicky.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you on again. It's been a few years, I think.
Well, thank you for having me. Yes, I think I was on in September of 2000.
Yes, oh my gosh, 3 years. Will you talk a little bit about your agency and the sorts of things that you especially like to represent?
Well, I do a lot of prescriptive nonfiction as well as narrative nonfiction. Narrative nonfiction could be biography, for example, whereas prescriptive nonfiction could be a parenting book, a child care book, a health book on how to deal with a particular health issue. I do books on women's issues. A lot of the fiction I do is in the mystery genre, although some of it is quite literary. So it's quite a range.
Yeah. Now, you were at Oxford University Press before starting your agency. What attracted you to start your own agency and have a small and quite effective agency in New York?
Well, I had been at Oxford University Press for almost 10 years, and I wanted to get into mainstream publishing because the University Press is a very particular kind of publishing. It's only nonfiction. It's only fairly academic nonfiction. And I wanted to work on a wider range of books. And I happened to meet an agent at a party, an agent named Charlotte Sheedy, and she was looking for someone, and I went to work with her for about a year and a half before starting my own agency. And I just thought I'd died and gone to heaven. It was exactly what I'd wanted to do. In my first 6 months of being an agent working at Charlotte's, I just couldn't figure out why everybody wasn't a literary agent.
Really? What was it that you immediately liked?
At Oxford, I had done quite a few different things, but when I was doing editing, it was just editing. When I was doing marketing, it was, you know, just preparing catalogs or just dealing with sales reps. What I loved about being an agent was the incredible variety. It was just a much greater range of skills that were called upon, I felt. You know, you were doing contracts, you were doing editorial work, you were working with authors, you were much more involved sort of in the business of publishing. You were doing deals, you were dealing with foreign rights, with audio rights, with magazine rights. So I loved the fact that within the course of an hour, I could be doing so many different things. I liked having so many irons in the fire. I liked that feeling of having so many, sorry for all the cliches, so many balls in the air. You know, you're
sure,
always handling several projects at once, and you're dealing with the projects that are about to be published, the projects you want to sell, the royalty statements from the books you sold 7 years ago, etc. I just love that variety.
What I've also noticed, especially recently about you, and I doubt if every agent is as you are, but in looking for, I think it was last week or the week before, looking for someone to feature in a department that I do for the ASJ Monthly, you were so positive and just so much a promoter of your clients, and that was actually impressive, because I don't know that agents take the time to do that.
Oh, well, thank you. That just seemed entirely natural. I think you were looking for authors who were journalists.
Yes.
And I came up with quite a number who, some of whom aren't strictly speaking journalists at newspapers or on the staff of magazines, but who write for newspapers or write about nonfiction.
Yes.
And do that kind of researched work. I just think that's part of what an agent does, is everything she can possibly think of for her client.
Hmm. That's interesting. I mean, I like that.
Well,
I like
you.
That about you. It seems, though, that even some of the best of agents very much are, once the book is sold, they're somewhat out of the picture. You know, it's like, okay, now it's the editor's job, now it's the publisher's job, now it's the publicist's job, and their job recedes until another book comes in that needs to be sold.
Well, I don't know. I spend a lot of time talking to my agent friends about how involved we get with publicity, with the cover, for example, if we have the chance with flap copy. So that is not, I mean, that's not my experience among sort of my circle of agents.
Hmm.
And my attitude and my agent friend's attitude has always been that publishers generally are happy to have all the help they can.
Yes.
For example, as you know, it's a publishing convention that the publisher retains paperback rights. That is, if you sell a hardcover to a publishing house, either they do the paperback themselves eventually or they sell those rights. I'm frequently, with, say, some of my mysteries, going on my own to paperback houses and saying, this book is coming out in hardcover. The paperback rights are available. Do you want an early look? Because the publishing houses are so overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
One hears stories about publishers sending cartons of hardcover books to paperback reprint houses.
Mm.
And so if an agent can get in there and help sort of individuate the books and provide supporting material, that's good for everybody. It's good for the client, and it's good for the agent, and it's good for the client's career.
Yes. Now, because publishing houses are, well, it seems like a bunch have cut staff and editors are overworked, how common is it for agents to get involved, say, with the editing process before the manuscript gets turned in, before the deadline date for the author to get it to that editor who bought the book?
That, I find that varies tremendously from author to author. Some of my authors always ask me to read their manuscripts before they turn it in. Some of my clients send me their finished manuscripts at the same time they send them to the editor. And it depends on the relationship the agent has with the writer. It depends on the writer's style. Depends whether the book is fiction or nonfiction. Depends on how experienced or professional the writer is. That is, you know, if you do a health book and there's a health writer who's already done 6 or 7 or 10 other health books, they pretty much know what is necessary, and I might not read that before it gets delivered.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here today with Vicki Bergeur a literary agent in New York and former AAR president. The AAR, now, this seems to be a big deal among writers, having your agent be a member of AAR.
Oh, I'm delighted to hear that, because that means the AAR is getting ever more high profile.
It sure is. I think it's a concern, at least among the writers and authors that I know, that the agents sort of, you know, it sort of provides that ethical assurance that if you're in AAR, you must be ethical. Not that everybody is, but, you know, it's like, it really is something I think that writers look for. And I'm curious how an agent becomes a member. Do you have to be an agent for a period of time? Or
I believe it's a minimum of 2 years, mm-hmm. I believe, and you need 2 letters of reference.
From publishers, other agents?
Other agents, uh-huh. or maybe from other members. I'm afraid I'm not up on the membership requirements, but they're listed on the AAR website.
Yes, and that's just AAR.com?
It's AAR-online.org.
Okay.
And I actually printed out 2 parts of the website, which I think are particularly impressive. There's a fabulous list of questions that a writer can ask a prospective agent.
What would some of them be?
Well, aside from, are you a member of the AAR? How long have you been in business? Do you have specialists at your agency who handle movie and television and foreign rights? Do you have sub-agents abroad or agents in Hollywood? Who in your agency will actually be handling my work? Will other staff members be familiar with my work and the status of my business? Will you oversee or at least keep me apprised of the work your agency's doing on my behalf? Do you have an agent-author agreement? How do you keep your clients informed of your activities on their behalf? Do you consult with your clients on any and all offers? What is your commission? What are your procedures and time frames for processing and disbursing client funds? That kind of thing.
Now, if you are looking for an agent and you pose a number of these questions to that agent, are most agents open about discussing this stuff, or do they become a little defensive and think you should know this if you're already approaching me?
Sometimes, for example, I'll get a blind query letter in the mail and someone will say to me, send me your client list, which I would never do. I share my client list with other people in the industry, but until I've reached an agreement with a writer that we want to work together, I wouldn't, for example, share my client list, but I'm certainly happy to answer questions.
Yeah. I just wonder how much a person, a writer, should know about an agent that they are hoping to have represent them. Should you know enough so that, you know, it's not so much a discovery process when you get them on the phone, but before you even send your query letter, you feel like this would be a good one?
Well, sometimes when writers are looking for agents, I tell them, look in books that you feel are comparable in some way to the one you're writing and see who represents that book,
mm-hmm.
and then approach that agent and say, I'm a big fan of such and such, or I know you represent this sort of book. Would you be willing to look at my book?
Yes.
Because that tells the agent that you've done your homework. For example, I don't handle much in the way of romance novels, and so if somebody writes me about a romance novel, it says to me, they probably haven't done much research.
Yes. Hmm. What about that being contacted? Do most of your clients come from referral, or do you actually find gems in the slush pile? Conferences? I don't know. I mean, how is it just a whole range of ways that clients come?
It's a range of ways. For example, right now, I'm enchanted by a time travel novel that someone sent me. And in fact, she was referred by somebody I don't know, but somebody she knew my name from somewhere. And I think agents sometimes take take a query more seriously if the writer's been referred by an editor, another agent, another writer, et cetera, or has researched and has discovered that the agent also represents X, Y, or Z author.
Yeah. Now, a time travel novel is, do your favorites or what you love when it comes in, does that change, or do you generally have, you know, a few different areas that when it comes through the door, if it's working, it's great. That's exactly what you've always wanted.
I think most agents probably find over time they do different things. You don't want to just keep doing the same thing over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say I've ever represented another time travel novel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that I was looking for a time travel novel. I just think this one works so well.
Yes.
And one of the things that really impresses me is that the dialogue of the character who suddenly appears from the late 18th century, and he sounds real. So often when people set fiction in the past, the characters all speak in a very stiff, formal way. Well, we have no idea really what people really sounded like,
mm-hmm.
but this author has been very clever in making this character sound so relaxed and so normal that you're not stopped dead by the stiffness and sort of archaic quality of the dialogue.
Mm-hmm. So how much will you read? Will you read, a chapter? Will you read a few chapters? Or can you tell in a page or two of, say, a section of fiction that someone might send you, whether you love it or not?
Well, it depends. Sometimes you read two pages and you know immediately that it's not for you. Sometimes the beginning's incredibly strong, but before I pick up the phone and call the writer, I make myself keep going, because sometimes things do fall apart. Sometimes the beginning is the strongest,
mm-hmm.
or the most unusual for whatever reason. If somebody writes me and says, I have a novel, I almost invariably ask just for the first, say, 3 chapters or 50 pages or 75 pages. I think that's in part psychological, because if I had a room full of entire manuscripts, I would just be paralyzed and I would never get to any of them. Whereas if I have chunks of 50 pages, it just seems more manageable. And then if I love those 50 pages, I will ask for the rest of the book.
Mm-hmm. What is the overriding reason for taking on a project? Is it because you love it? Is it because you think it's marketable? Is it because right now trends are pointing toward this manuscript?
It's really the first two reasons. A, I love it, and B, I think I can sell it. That is, there's no point in an agent taking on something just because she loves it if she knows darn well it's never going to sell,
mm-hmm.
for whatever reason. The criteria for nonfiction are very different from the criteria for fiction. But in either case, it's rarely because of a trend. And I think we agents always trip ourselves up when we say to ourselves, well, I'll take this on because it's hot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, therein lies disaster often.
Yes. I am speaking with Vicki Berger, a literary agent based in New York City, and you're still listening to Writers on Writing, and stay with us. We'll have Vicki for the entire hour. A minute ago, Vicki, you said the criteria is different for fiction versus nonfiction. Could you elaborate?
Well, fiction, obviously, one's taste in fiction is highly subjective. Every agent I know has a story about the one that got away. That is, the novel that came in that you had reservations about, that you just didn't get, that wasn't to your particular style, and then some other agent took it on and it became a wild bestseller.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone has that story. I have heard there are agents who will sometimes reject things and say in the letter, this is unpublishable. I would never say that because taste is so subjective. And just because something isn't right for my agency doesn't, I just could never make that declaration.
Yes.
With nonfiction, with certain kinds of nonfiction, you think about the market and you think, is there a market for this? And also, how do we reach the market? The big buzzword, I'm sure you have heard and your listeners have heard, the big buzzword these days is platform.
Yes, I was just thinking that.
Does the author have a column in a newspaper, a radio show, a track record, a killer website? Is he or she quoted frequently in the press? You know, has she racked up a number of appearances on early morning television? Does she have videotape of her TV, you know, appearances, etc.? So that's, you know, that's a large part of selling nonfiction. I was thinking, you know, if you look at the bestseller list, which we all hate to do, it's astonishing how many of the books in nonfiction are by people who have major platforms outside publishing. You know, Al Franken was on Saturday Night mm-hmm. Live and has a background, I mean, you know, aside from his Harvard undergraduate degree and his long history of writing, he was on Saturday Night Live.
Yes.
That was probably where he first came to public attention. Bill O'Reilly has a TV show. Michael Moore was known as a documentarian, a very successful documentarian, before Stupid White Man came out.
Mm-hmm.
I think Dr. Phil was on Oprah
yes.
before some publisher grabbed him. Laura Schlesinger had her radio show,
mm-hmm.
etc. So now, you know, there are many, many exceptions to this, but publishers love it. You know, Paul Krugman and Thomas Friedman appear, you know, every week in the Times editorial page. That helps sell books.
Yes. Well, I want to talk to you more about platform and how it influences advances when we come back.
Okay.
So let's take a real quick break. Stay with us. We'll be back with more Vicki Bergeur in just a minute. Don't go anywhere. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and at the top of the hour, you heard I'll Close My Eyes by Dinah Washington, and you just heard Come Back Baby by Brian Barrett. We're back with Vicki Bergeur, who is a literary agent in New York City. Okay, back to platform, Vicki.
Yes.
Now, how does platform influence advances in terms of, say you have an author who has a great topic but doesn't have much of a platform, but a publisher's willing to take a chance, and you have another author who has a great topic and does have a platform. Maybe they're even similar types of books. I don't know. But could an advance vary greatly?
Yes.
Because of one's platform and the other's absence of a platform?
Yes. And I think some nonfiction authors, if there's no platform, it's going to be really hard to sell the book. I was kind of shocked recently. I have a book I've been trying to sell by a doctor, and he's a very fine doctor and a wonderful human being, and he's a professor at a medical school, etc. But he hasn't published particularly much. He's not high up in various organizations. And there was a publisher, a small publisher, a rather academic publisher, who was interested for a while and then said, we're really looking for doctor/authors who have a more distinguished background.
Hmm.
Now, it's not that he wasn't a great doctor,
right?
But he wasn't, high up on the faculty of one of the great, great medical schools, for example.
Yes.
Or very active in, this or that medical
or scientific academy.
Mm-hmm. So then I'd assume that platform matters little when it comes to fiction. Is that true?
It matters little.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, it's a totally different animal. I was shocked about 5 or 6 years ago. I was having lunch with an editor who does a lot of literary fiction, and she actually said to me that it really helped if a fiction writer was telegenic. I was horrified.
Gosh.
But that's the kind of culture we're in right now.
Yeah.
It's very important for a nonfiction author to be telegenic or articulate or personable, etc. And one would hope it wouldn't matter for a fiction writer, but some publishers are concerned with that.
So is there ageism in publishing, or is it still more about the word? Because in Hollywood, there's so much of that. Over 40, many people retire from their Hollywood careers, and certainly by 50, they're, unless you know you're a big time something or other, you're looking for something else.
You mean as a screenwriter?
Yeah, well, anywhere in Hollywood, really. But yeah, I am talking more about the writing.
I don't think much about the issue of ageism. I know that, for example, after the wild success of White Teeth by Zadie Smith,
mm-hmm.
A lot of 23-year-old and 24-year-old fiction writers felt they had to get published immediately and that the publishers all wanted the next 24-year-old or 25-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
I had some assistants who had MFAs, and they were astounding in their ambition and their focus, and damned if several of them didn't get book contracts at a very young age. So that's not exactly ageism. It's sort of age as marketing tool.
Right.
That's not to say that a 55-year-old writer or 62-year-old writer is going to have more problems than he or she once would have.
Right. Interesting. So it probably is still ultimately more about the word, especially
yes.
in fiction.
Yes, I would say so, and I would hope so.
Yes. What about, and this has been sort of a debate and an ongoing talk among ASJA members right now, and that is that some feel and have heard that publishers frown on journalists who turn to fiction. Have you found it a hard sell, or because I know you represent journalists, but I don't know if you represent journalists who were journalists and now fiction writers.
Well, Laura Lippman.
Yes, and she was on the show a few weeks ago.
And James Salas has always written fiction, but he used to do a lot of journalism.
Mm-hmm.
But he wrote poetry and short stories and did a lot of nonfiction and journalism and then turned more and more to writing novels.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see that as an issue, that is a publisher's reluctance to entertain fiction by someone who's a former journalist. When I get a query letter, for example, if it's for a novel, and the writer says, I've been a journalist for X number of years, or I've had a column in my local newspaper, or I've had short stories published in X, Y, and Z. I always feel any kind of writing done over, you know, a sustained period of time is a sign that this person is very serious about writing.
Mm-hmm.
So I know I'm impressed if somebody has had an impressive career as a journalist and now is writing fiction.
Yes.
It's not an issue for me, and I haven't encountered that.
Mm-hmm.
But you're saying that ASJA members have.
A few have, I suppose, and find it interesting. Last year at our conference, we had a panel of agents, mostly agents, and I think there was an editor from the Paris Review, maybe another literary journal, and they all seem to be in agreement that if you were a journalist, you really shouldn't even think about writing fiction, because you probably wouldn't do it very well. You would do journalism well, but you might not.
That's a different issue.
Okay.
I think. That is, I think there are people who are brilliant journalists who probably can't write fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure that any, that just because somebody's been a journalist prejudices the editor.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. This is good. What about short story collections? Do you like to deal with those, or do you find it a terribly hard sell, no matter how much you might love the stories?
I think it's really hard. Several years ago, someone came to me with it. It was just clearly an outstanding collection. And I would have taken her on. She went with another agent who had done more in the way of representing the sort of writing she was doing, and I was not surprised to see that the first story in the collection was within 6 months in The New Yorker.
Hmm.
So something has to be, and the other agent did sell her collection to a major trade publishing house, but it has to really sweep you off your feet.
Yes. You just mentioned one of her stories ended up in The New Yorker. Do agents typically, if they take you on, whether for a short story collection or really anything, will you help place your clients, especially say if a book is coming out, try to get their book excerpted here and there, or you know, try to find places for them the way publicists might?
You mean to feature reprint their parts of their work?
Yeah, to reprint their work, or maybe you have a nonfiction author who would be a natural as a columnist for some, whatever their topic is, in a major women's magazine or men's magazine, depending
yes,
on who. Yeah,
I think agents do a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, there's such a thing as first serial rights, which means the right to excerpt part of a book before publication. Agents used to keep first serial rights more frequently than they do now. They used to be easier to sell. There used to be many more outlets. There used to be a ton of women's magazines that published fiction, and hardly any of them do anymore.
Yeah.
And those women's magazines used to publish both short stories and excerpts from forthcoming novels. And I'm hard-pressed to name magazines that are still doing that kind of fiction. It was great publicity for the book because, with hope, a magazine reader would read the excerpt of the novel and then rush out to buy the novel when it came out the following month.
Hmm.
As for finding other outlets for writers, I think many agents are always trying to do that.
Interesting. So you have two advocates. You have your publicist at the publishing company, and hopefully you have your agent.
Right.
Yes.
For example, Modern Library, as you know, reprints classics, and they reprint these classics with introductions by contemporary writers. And I had a writer who I thought would be just perfect for writing introductions. That is, he was a true man of letters. He wrote fiction, he wrote nonfiction, and he wrote criticism, and he was incredibly well-versed in all kinds of literature. So that's, you know, that's the sort of thing I might try and do is, you know, get him a gig at with Modern Library writing an introduction.
Uh-huh. Okay. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Vicki Bourgeur, and she's a literary agent in New York, and we have a bit of time left. So many things still to ask you. What about selling fiction right now? Is it terribly hard, or has it always been hard?
I think it's probably harder than it was. I think people used to be given much more of a chance to make it than they are now. That is, publishers, a lot of agents will tell you that it's easier to sell a first novel than a second or third novel by the same writer if the first one hasn't done fabulously. I think in the past, a publisher would make much more of a commitment to a writer. I mean, you know, Anne Tyler is often cited as someone who wrote several novels before she began to get the kind of critical acclaim and commercial success that she has now.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if her career had started 10 or 20 years later, the publisher might not have stuck with her.
Yeah.
She's sort of a classic example that's
sure.
often cited.
Hmm.
That publishers are much more interested now in the bottom line. More and more publishers are owned by conglomerates that are in other businesses as well as in publishing. They want a higher return, you know, ROI, return on investment, etc.
Hmm. So do you ever not take on a project you love because you're not sure you can sell it?
Yes, because
yeah?
it's too heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you know, agents, unlike most other people in many lines of work, don't get paid unless they sell something. You
yeah.
know, if you hire a publicist, the publicist gets thousands of dollars up front, whether or not she gets you on the Today Show, a freelance
right.
publicist.
Yes.
If you hire a lawyer who's not working on a contingency, you know, you pay a retainer, whether or not the lawyer wins your case. But an agent doesn't get a single penny until she sells your book, and she could have devoted 2 years to, or more, to editing it, to sending it out. You know, you hear stories about agents who sent out books to, well, 20 houses is nothing unusual, 30, 40. I heard recently about a fiction writer who's done brilliantly. He's done extraordinarily well. And I don't know if this is apocryphal. His agent for 9 years tried to sell his novel and went to something like 102 houses. And you say, well, there aren't 102 houses. But over the course of 9 years, there's so much turnover in publishing that you could keep going back to the same house, but simply to a new editor.
Yes.
And
sold it?
And he sold it.
That's great. But my gosh.
Yeah. And that agent was, you know, time is money for agents.
What about for fee agents? You know, in Writer's Market, in the literary agents book that Writer's Digest puts out, there's a whole section on agents that will take that 15% and don't require a fee. And then there's another section of a ton of agents that charge reading fees. What do you think about that? Is that something that if a writer tries to get an agent that is not fee-charging and just can't seem to do it, that they should go to a fee-charging agent?
Only after doing a lot of research and talking to other people who are represented by that agent. I think that's a really slippery slope. The AAR canon of ethics prohibits its members from charging fees. And there's a lot of abuse of reading fees. There, you know, there have been articles in newspapers. There have been federal investigations into agents who charge fees, collect a lot of money, and then don't try and sell the book in the end.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that all fee-charging agents can't be trusted. I'm just saying to be careful.
Well, and you would think, though, that You want an agent who does make their money selling books
right.
as opposed to charging reading fees.
Yes.
And if you have an agent that needs to charge a reading fee, that maybe they're just not that great an agent.
Well, let me read you what the AAR Canon of Ethics says, and this is on the website. The AAR believes that the practice of literary agents charging clients or potential clients for reading and evaluating literary works, including outlines, proposals, and partial or complete manuscripts, is subject to serious abuse that reflects adversely on our profession.
Hmm.
For that reason, members may not charge clients or potential clients for reading and evaluating literary works and may not benefit directly or indirectly from the charging for such services by any other person or entity.
Interesting. That is interesting. What about somebody sends you a client or a potential client, say someone you just know, so someone who's a publicist, a freelance publicist, someone who is just maybe, you know, just has a writer's group. They send you a client and they say, if you take this client on, I would really like a kickback of some sort.
I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
That's how agents, you know, agents get clients by referrals.
Yes.
Not by paying for referrals.
Right.
So I wouldn't do that.
Now, how much does personality of your potential client matter to you? If you love the work, if you love the writing, are you going to pay a whole lot of attention to personality, or is that sort of an important part of the equation?
I think it's a two-way street. That is, I think the author's sense of the agent and the agent's sense of the author is equally important.
Mm-hmm.
I think ideally an agent and a potential client should meet, although I have many clients I've never met, but we each have gotten, by the time we have arrived at a decision to work together, there's been correspondence, there's been phone conversations, there have been editorial letters, there's been a lot of email. And so we should have a strong sense of each other. And I think it's very important. You know, the truism is that this is like a marriage.
Yes.
So, yes. I mean, I remember being very impressed. An agent friend said to me once about a woman she didn't take on as a client. She said, I could tell she was going to be a real handful.
Mm-hmm.
and I have agent friends who say to me about someone they didn't take on, life is too short.
Right.
But it's, as I say, it goes both ways.
Hmm.
That is, I think a writer should feel very comfortable with his or her agent.
Hmm.
Don't you?
Well, sure I do.
Yes.
It seems, though, that that's not always possible. I mean, you know, especially say you've tried and tried to get an agent and haven't, or just, you know, whatever you're marketing, whatever you're trying to sell, just hasn't clicked with whoever it is you wanted. And
mm-hmm.
then you find somebody who is quite competent and at least they're behind the work, then my thought is that most writers would say, well, then it doesn't matter if I'm not that comfortable. If they sell it, they sell it.
Well, that's true. It's, you know, there are people who say, I really don't care about my doctor's bedside manner. I have enormous faith and trust in his or her ability.
Right.
And I really don't care if the doctor has a good bedside manner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ideally the client and the agent enjoy each other, but it's a business relationship. I mean, I have a mantra, you know, goes, it's a business relationship, it's a business relationship. And that's for the clients I love.
Yes.
I don't think you have to feel this is going to be a great friendship.
Right.
But you have to feel the writer should feel the agent is someone he or she can trust in all manners of ways,
mm-hmm.
you know, not just financially, but in terms of discretion and privacy and editorial judgment.
Yes.
And the agent ideally feels that the client is a reasonable person with, you know, I'll leave it at that, a reasonable person.
We have a few minutes left with Vicki Bergeur. We've only touched on query letters, and I know they're so important in terms of a query letter is the first point of contact typically between you and a potential client, be they a fiction writer or a nonfiction. Could you say a few words about queries and what matters to you in a query letter? Can you truly get a sense of the writer and or the work, the style of the writing through a query letter, which is basically a business, a piece of business correspondence.
I do not expect to get a sense of the style of writing from a query letter. The only way you get a sense of the style of writing is from the work itself, especially with fiction. That is, as we say, it's all in the execution. That's why, for example, if I get a query letter from someone who has a novel, and he or she sends a query letter and a synopsis, I still have no idea about the style of the writing. That is, a synopsis on its own is totally useless.
Yes.
However, the query letter can tell you if the author can write, can spell, and most especially is a professional, serious person. I cannot tell you how many query letters I've gotten that start, "I've written a fictional novel." And in the query letter, I want to know also, there should be a paragraph about the writer. What else does the writer do besides write? You know, is the writer a full-time writer? Is he or she a lawyer or a retired postal worker or a column, you know, et cetera?
Yes.
I get a zillion query letters from people who go on about their novel and don't tell me anything about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't tell anything about the style of writing, but you can tell if somebody's serious and professional.
When somebody is querying you about a novel, does it make sense for them to include a page or two from it?
I think it makes wonderful sense to include the first chapter or two.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, different agents feel differently, but I can't see any harm. There's no downside except the expense for the writer.
Yes.
And it's not that much, you know, it's another stamp, generally. because it's almost impossible to tell with a novel without actually seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I found, someone was once recounting to me the plot of a bestseller, and it sounded so ludicrous in synopsis form.
Mm.
That is, something that might sound completely ludicrous in synopsis form draws the reader in from the first page.
Yes.
Sometimes writers make the mistake of sending chapter 17 only because it's the best chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's useless. You want to see how the writer introduces character and conveys setting and sets up the premise, etc.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Oh, we are about at the end of our time. Vicki, would you like to tell listeners how to get in touch with you?
Well, I'm listed in Literary Marketplace.
Okay. And that can be found at the library.
I much prefer written queries, and I'd rather just leave it that I'm my address is on the AAR website, which is, again, AAR-online.org, or in Literary Marketplace.
Yes, and Literary Marketplace, I believe most libraries have that book in
yes.
the reference section, most major libraries. I know here in Newport Beach we have it at the main library and so on and so forth. Any last words, any words of advice that you'd like to give our listeners?
I once heard a writer who had finally found a publisher say her advice to other writers was never give up, never give up, never give up. And I loved that. I know too many stories of people who had a hard time finding an agent and then after a long while found the perfect agent. I know too many stories of agents who tried to sell something, you know, as we were saying, to 20 houses and then hit it on the 25th house.
Yes.
And so I think never give up is as good advice as I can give.
Yes, excellent advice. Vicki, thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome. And I just once again appreciate your time. You're wonderful to talk to. And
well, thank you so much for having me, and we'll talk soon.
Excellent.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
That was Vicki Berger speaking to us from New York City. And, yeah, her clients rave about her, and she raves about her clients, which is a wonderful thing to see that, to hear that from agents. If you'd like to know more about Writers on Writing, you can go to my website at writersonwriting.com. There you can email me and If you want to be on my weekly email list, you can tell me that and email me from the site. I'd like to leave you with a quote by Joyce Carol Oates, who said, "If you are a writer, you locate yourself behind a wall of silence, and no matter what you are doing, driving a car or walking or doing housework, you can still be writing because you have that space." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM and KUCI in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'll be back next week. Talk to you then.